You are listening to Primary Care Perspectives, a podcast where pediatric experts from Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and other guests discuss primary care issues that are on their minds and the hot topics that all pediatricians see affecting their daily practice. This podcast is for general informational and educational purposes only and is not to be considered as medical advice for any particular patient. Clinicians must rely on their own informed clinical judgment in making recommendations to their patients. Hi, I'm Dr. Katie Lockwood, a primary care pediatrician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and today I'm talking about an anti-racist approach in primary care. And joining me, I have two experts who I'm really excited to be here because I have trained with them over the years, and I've just loved watching them come into their expert role. So to introduce them to you all, I'll start first with Dr. George Dallenbert. Dr. Dallenbert is an attending physician in the Division of General Pediatrics at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, or CHOP, and an assistant professor of clinical pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He is also the associate director of the Center for Health Equity and a core faculty member at Clinical Futures and a faculty scholar at the CHOP Policy Lab and a senior fellow of the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. Thank you so much for being here with us today, Dr. Dallenbert.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And our next expert is Dr. Aditi Vasan. Dr. Vasan is an attending physician in the Division of General Pediatrics, an associate fellow of the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics, a core faculty member at Clinical Futures, and a research scholar at the Center for Injury Research and Prevention. So welcome, Dr. Vasan.
Thanks so much for having me, Katie.
As you can tell, these two bring with them a wealth of experience, but also you both were recently authors of the pediatrics commentary called An Anti-Racist Approach to Social Care Integration, which was published in January of 2024. And this paper proposes that while many institutions attempt to implement social care interventions, in order for these to be equitable and beneficial for all patients, they must be grounded in an anti-racist approach. So we are going to explore more about what you mean by this and the recommendations that you made in this commentary. So I'm really excited to dig into this with both of you. So thanks so much for bringing this topic to the podcast today.
Excited to be able to speak more to it.
Yeah, so let's start with a little bit of background on why you wanted to write this commentary in the first place. As I mentioned, there are some frameworks for social care integration and addressing racism in child health that already exist in the pediatric literature and guide institutions who are doing this work. Could you tell us a little bit more about those and what you wanted to add in this sphere?
Sure. I think we really wanted to bring an anti-racism and racial equity frame to social needs screening and support. We owe a lot to the 2019 National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine report on integrating social care into healthcare. We thought that was a really valuable framework for these interventions, but we did a sort of control F of that document, and there was no mention of racism as a key driver of social risks and resulting health inequities. And we felt like this was an important omission and that the framework could really use augmentation by adding a specific focus on how to make sure that social care interventions are really equitable and beneficial for all families.
Yeah, that's so important. That's a good detail, obviously, that you picked up on and that you addressed in your commentary. Your commentary really talks about how we can address three types of racism: structural, institutional, and interpersonal and internalized racism. So I thought we could talk about each of these a little bit more for listeners who may not be familiar with how you sort of divided up types of racism. So let's start by talking about structural racism. So this refers to macro level conditions such as public policies, laws, and rules that are built into our communities. And I think a lot of pediatricians are aware that structural racism leads to health inequities, and hopefully many are screening for some of these, such as things like food or housing insecurity. Your commentary, though, highlights that our interventions shouldn't end at the screening and referring. So why is supporting the connection to resources so important in the context of structural racism?
Yeah, I'm happy to start on that one. So I think that one of the things that we really wanted to do was to ground our audience's understanding in a framework that was digestible in order to help make our recommendations actionable. And so that's why we borrowed from the three levels of racism that were originated by Dr. Kamaro Phelous-Jones And it was really a acknowledgement that to screen and refer is only to partially acknowledge the problems of structural racism. And if you don't think about what barriers might be in place in terms of facilitating connection and what role you can play as a health system to facilitate that connection to resources, then you're actually only getting partway towards the solution mm-hmm. of actually helping to address the social needs of families.
So important. Yeah, I think, like you said, we're just doing half of a step almost, right? Like, it feels like a big step because it took us a while to get there even, to do the screening and do the referring and know what the resources are, but we're just not passing it all the way and getting that connection to families. And so, so important. Thank you for calling that out in your commentary too.
Yeah, and I think that part of what you note is also important. We should give credit for coming this far. That is important. And also, there is more work to be done. And I think that that is part of what this article really sought to do, is to help push us to what does the ideal implementation of this type of work look like? And how do we actually structure our approaches to get there?
And I love that you mentioned that your goal was really to make your commentary actionable, because in reading it, I really felt that. And I think sometimes articles like this can feel a little abstract, and it's hard for people to then think about, well, how do I actually put this into my practice? And so I really appreciate the kind of tangible items that you have in your commentary that make it feel like something that people can really just jump right into and doesn't feel quite as challenging, which I think sometimes when it's in the abstract concept, you're like, how can I address racism? That's such a big topic. What am I as one individual going to do? And I think you've really helped make that feel personal.
Absolutely. Just overcoming that decision paralysis, that sense of, oh my gosh, this is such a big, heavy topic. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll just do something else that's a little bit easier.
Right. Right. Well, we're not going to do that. We're going to stick with the hard stuff. We're going to keep tackling it with your commentary helping us. Now, the next big topic that you address is institutional racism, and you call for pediatric health systems to evaluate all patient-facing policies through an anti-racist lens. Let's acknowledge, though, that our pediatric workforce does not always reflect the diversity of our pediatric communities. So can you talk about why using an anti-racist lens on patient-facing policies should include community engagement?
Yeah, that's a great question, Katie. I think we really wanted to emphasize the importance of understanding how patient-facing policies can impact patients and families and can impact certain groups of families differentially, right? Mm-hmm. We know that because of structural racism, access to transportation is often harder in Black and other minoritized communities. And so when you penalize families for being late to appointments, this could be because they had to take 2 or 3 buses to get there. And so thinking about those kinds of institutional policies around access to care, and as a result, access to social needs screening, we really want health systems to critically evaluate how their existing policies might differentially impact minoritized groups and therefore keep them from even accessing the social needs screening and support programs we've created.
Yeah, that's great. I remember learning that lesson in my outpatient primary care continuity clinic as a resident when we were talking about late policies. But it is something that I think people struggle with because they're trying to also balance, you know, their clinics running or their hospital appointments staying on schedule. And so your point really about community engagement is so important because it's coming to solutions together, right? Like, what screening do we need to do to help overcome those barriers, to help improve access? And not that we're going to expect everyone to always be late because public transportation is hard, but how can we help assist them in that process? And we really need to engage community members to come to those solutions together.
I definitely agree. And I think that as we consider what that engagement looks like, we can borrow from some research frameworks, for example, that exist, where community involvement really exists on a spectrum. You think about from outreach all the way to kind of like shared leadership on initiatives. And again, just to kind of lower the activation energy a little bit for people getting involved in this work, start wherever you can on that spectrum, whether it's outreach, consultation, general involvement, collaboration. Maybe you are at the point where you have a community advisory board and you can like really lean into shared leadership. That's excellent. But really taking that step to really move towards the idea of nothing about us without us, that phrase that really, you know, saw its initial rise with the South African disability rights movement in the 1990s, really grounding in the idea that we are not the people who have the lived experience that will necessarily inform what it looks like to build these systems in a way that is effective for the end users. Mm-hmm. So we just have to go and get that information and make sure that those people have a voice and a seat at the table.
Yeah, that's great. We talked about something similar in a prior episode about disability and also including patients who may have a disability in the process of evaluating things like our office, just physical structure and policies. So it's a real similar kind of overlap here, as you mentioned, with some of the laws. Now, in addressing interpersonal racism, you talk about the importance of bias training, longitudinal structural competency training, and using data-driven decisions and standardized screening processes. So can you give us an example, though, of interpersonal racism in clinical care for those who may be thinking that there's no way that they provide biased care?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we have seen in the data, especially around social needs screening, that when you implement screening processes that are left up to the clinician's discretion, there are sometimes differences in who ends up getting screened and who gets referred to resources. And so this is something that's proven by data from other institutions and something that we've definitely observed. I think we also see interpersonal racism in clinical care in a lot of insidious ways in the families who are labeled as difficult or challenging, or in the families where we question their fitness to care for their children more than we might for other families. And a lot of that has to do with our implicit and explicit biases that I think we have to acknowledge we all have as clinicians. Mm-hmm. We're not saying that anyone is ill-intentioned in the care that we provide. We know that as pediatricians, we are generally a caring and thoughtful group who wants to provide the very best care for everyone who walks in our door. But I think there are ways in which these biases creep into our language, into our care in sort of insidious ways. Mm-hmm. And our goal isn't to blame individuals for them. It's really to build a system that minimizes the effect that that implicit or explicit bias can have.
Yeah, pediatricians are the best, right? But also, that's why it's called implicit bias, right? You might not realize that you have it. And that's why these trainings can be so helpful and standardized processes in the office can be so helpful too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's important to call out, because I think one of the biggest pushbacks on this can be, oh my gosh, they're calling me racist. Mm-hmm. I am not racist. Right. Like this policy is like not for me. Mm-hmm. And like losing people at that step. And it is not about calling people explicitly racist. Mm-hmm. It is really about that acknowledgement of we get a lot of input and we are constantly processing that input. And we just think about all of the social signaling that we see on the news as we're growing up that really helps to form our worldviews. Mm-hmm. And then the subtle confirmation biases that can happen when you're in training and you notice that some people are at the bedside a little bit more than others. And then you start to kind of like make that connection of like, well, are those the people who like really care about their kids? Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you're not inpatient and you're in the primary care setting. And now you're bringing that type of understanding into a situation without really realizing that the people who are at the bedside are the people who have the ability and the luxury of being at the bedside.
Right.
And maybe somebody else is working multiple jobs because that is the structure in which they exist and have to navigate. Mm-hmm. And so we get these subtle ways in which our biases are reaffirmed that can, at the surface, like really have nothing to do with race. Mm-hmm. And it's only with that deeper interrogation and thinking about the connections and more of some of those upstream factors that give you a collinearity between some of the outcomes that you might see and the racism that's at play, that you really figure out how is this actually affecting my personal views? And then how are those personal views affecting my interactions with others?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that personal inventory is so important. It kind of leads into our next topic, which is the last topic you addressed is internalized racism. And I'm so glad that you included this because I think it's often overlooked as something that we as healthcare providers can't solve or is outside the realm of healthcare. So I'm hoping that you can explain why it's so important to consider internalized racism in implementing social needs screening.
Yeah, I think social needs screening is different from a lot of other disease screening that we do in primary care and in the inpatient setting, in that we aren't screening for a disease process that we're hoping to identify, and we're screening for needs that families understand and that they know that they have. And I think screening, if it's not implemented thoughtfully, could be perceived by families as a way in which we're focusing on their deficits rather than their strengths, as a way in which we're trying to find fault with what they're able to do and provide for their family. Mm-hmm. And so I think the framing of screening is really important in the context of internalized racism. It's important that we, again, really partner with families and community members to ask them how they think we should structure and approach these screening questions, and also that we frame them in the context of universal screening in order to provide support, right? We're not asking these questions because we're worried about your child or we think there's something wrong with you as a family. We ask these questions to every single family because we know it's hard to raise a child in this context, in this community, and we want to give you all the support that we can.
That's a really helpful framing perspective for us to keep in mind and to think about how we are leading into the screening. Like, what are they reading before they open up those questions, or before you ask those questions? How are you framing the context of it? So thank you for highlighting that for us. Now, I imagine that many people who are listening are right on board, following along, thinking, yes, I want to do all of this. I'm going to read the commentary. I'm drinking the Kool-Aid. I love it. But why might a healthcare system resist some of these anti-racist approaches?
I think that it is important to just recognize that we're already doing a lot. We are already thinking about how can we deliver high quality clinical care? What does that look like? We are navigating prior auths. We are doing all of the work that maybe we have traditionally thought of as a doctor, physician, health system work. And so we'd be remiss to not acknowledge and once again give credit for that. And I think that part of what this call is meant to do is to push us to think about how do we address some of these factors that you get that off-quoted citation, 80% of somebody's outcomes are really attributable to non-healthcare influences, right? Like, how are we actually addressing some of those upstream drivers of the care outcomes that we're seeing?
Right.
And how do we lean into our potential as well as our responsibility and the opportunity to help to navigate some of those issues?
Yeah, so important. As you mentioned, just a few times we've talked about how much work we've done and we've come a far way in healthcare, but we have room to grow as well. I'm hoping you can share, though, some of the examples of how we're using an anti-racist approach in social care integration in CHOP primary care clinics, because I know there's been a lot of exciting work that's been happening and is ongoing.
Yeah, I am happy to share a little bit about the work that we have begun to implement in our social needs assessment and connection work. I think that a big part of that is integrating community health navigators as a kind of like centerpiece of the execution of this work. And so our community health navigators are individuals from the community with lived experience who can then really lean into the data that we have about the impact of community health workers as a bridge to our patients to help to make the introduction of this topic maybe a little less stigmatizing, to help to make the navigation of these challenges maybe a little bit easier because you have somebody that you can connect with and really not just waiting for the mandates to come, even though, you know, CMS have started to kind of like move in that direction, but really trying to get ahead of the requirements, which can often lead to a little bit of that checkbox mentality of like, all right, what's the thing that I have to do to, you know, make sure I don't get cited, make sure I don't get fined, make sure I don't, you know, leave dollars on the table and think about like, how do we really design this using quality improvement principles to continually iteratively refine our processes so that we are offering services and helping people to connect to these services in a way that minimizes stigma and just really leans into our potential as a healthcare system.
I'll just add that I think two important things we're doing are measuring outcomes and screening, you know, both process mm-hmm. measures. How often are we screening? How many families are we reaching? And really patient and family-centered outcomes. So who is able to connect to resources? Are those resources beneficial to them? Mm-hmm. And then looking at how those outcomes break down for different groups. I think I'm really trying to get input from community members and from the families impacted by these programs and input in meaningful ways. So compensating families for their feedback, making sure that they're allowed to provide and encouraged to provide really honest feedback at every stage of the process, and that we are then translating that feedback into meaningful improvements. I think that's been a big part of this process, is really trying to build trust and engagement with the patients served by these programs.
Well, I really appreciate the thoughtful approach. You know, being a child primary care physician, I'm using the things that you are all developing. And I really appreciate the thoughtfulness in the rollout, and that we're not, you know, screening for things that we aren't equipped to address, and that we're using a real data-driven approach to looking at the outcomes of our screening. So I appreciate that and all the work that you're doing at Clinical Futures and in other centers at CHOP as well. I'm wondering what's next, and what are you hoping the readers of this commentary will take away and learn from this?
There is a growing movement around thinking about these issues and doing this work. And I think that we'd be remiss not to shout out our co-author, Arvin Garg, who is a general pediatrician, health equity researcher at UMass, for his kind of really convening our group and getting us thinking about how could we really add our voice to the guidance of this issue. And we need kind of like more voices discussing what are the challenges, what's working, what critical assessments are we doing of the implementation approaches that we're taking, and what really kind of come out as the secret sauce to being able to do this well, and making sure that that sauce is not so secret. And as we think about it, a lot of people can talk about like the devil's in the details. I think the opportunity's in the details. Mm-hmm. And as we rethink what some of the frameworks for social care integration can look like and what the execution looks like, I think making sure that we don't get caught in that situation where research just kind of like sits in places, even in, you know, wonderful journals like Pediatrics, where our commentary was published, mm-hmm. and really transitions into the real world where it can have the most benefit for the patients that we're seeking to serve.
That's great. Yeah. And we're hoping that this podcast also helps translate to the real world, so that listeners who maybe didn't read your commentary are now learning from you. Maybe they'll go take a look at it, and maybe they'll incorporate some of the things that we talked about today into their practice.
Yeah, I think we're also really hoping that this will help people reframe screening as the start of a process rather than, as George said, a box to check as a result of a growing number of requirements. And we really see screening, as George said, as an opportunity to build engagement from community members. But we think that in order for that to happen, it needs to be done in the right way and really thought of as the first step in a process of meaningfully connecting families to resources, mm-hmm. rather than a box to check for health systems to then pat themselves on the back and say, hey, we've done this. So we hope that this leads to continued conversation and engagement, especially around the idea that screening is just a first step. And really what we should be thinking about is how we can support and sustain resource connection for families.
So well said. And thank you both so much for sharing your expertise with us today and really digging into your commentary a little bit more to explain some of those concepts and give us some ideas of actionable items that we can take back to our practices. And again, I appreciate everything you've done for us within CHOP Primary Care and how far we've come just in my time working there. And I'm excited to see where we continue to take this. So thank you both so much. And again, read their commentary in Pediatrics January 2024 called An Anti-Racist Approach to Social Care Integration. Thank you, Dr. Dallenbert and Dr. Vasan.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having us. Thank you for the interest in the piece and the work.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Primary Care Perspectives. You can download and subscribe to future episodes on iTunes or visit chop.edu/PCP podcast for a listing of all episodes. I look forward to our next chat.